Welcome to the History AI Podcast, where the past comes alive with facts, anecdotes, and a dash of humor. Here are your hosts, Chuck and Marco.
Two boys enter the Tower of London in 1483 and are never seen again. No trial, no burial record, no definitive evidence. Are they murdered, hidden, or did England just collectively decide not to ask too many questions?
And why do the best suspects include a king, a future king, and a duke with a taste for chaos?
Today, the princes in the tower, what we know, what we don't, and what makes this cold case still feel hot. Welcome back to the History AI Podcast. I'm Chuck.
And I'm Marco. This is the show where we put history on the stand, cross-examine the sources, and let a very sophisticated AI pull the dusty files without sneezing.
This show runs on the latest AI architecture for fast, up-to-date research support and snappy fact-checking. And, quick note, our episodes are evergreen. So whether you're listening on a commute today or rediscovering this episode years from now, it'll hold up. Also, be sure to subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Also, be sure to stay tuned after the episode for the original song Ravens Over London, The Princes in the Tower.
Today, the princes Edward V and his little brother Richard of Shrewsbury. Sons of King Edward IV. They vanish in 1483 after being lodged in the tower. It's one of England's most stubborn mysteries.
We'll lay out the timeline, name the suspects, weigh the evidence, and explain why Shakespeare is brilliant but not a court stenographer.
Spoiler, nobody gets off easy.
Okay, rewind to the spring of 1483. England's playing succession Jenga. Edward IV, Yorkist king, big victories, bigger personality, dies suddenly on April 9, 1483. His heir, Edward V, is about 12, living at Ludlow under the guardianship of his uncle Anthony Woodville, Earl Rivers.
Key detail, Edward IV had married Elizabeth Woodville in a surprise love match back in 1464. Her large, ambitious family, the Woodvilles, rose fast. Old-line nobles grumbled that the in-laws were hoarding offices, marriages, and influence like it was Black Friday.
When Edward IV dies, the Woodvilles move quickly. Rivers and young Edward V start toward London for a planned May coronation. Meanwhile, Edward IV's brother Richard, Duke of Gloucester, a loyal lieutenant in previous wars, heads south, teamed up with Henry Stafford, Duke of Buckingham. On paper, Richard's the perfect Lord Protector during the minority. In practice, the political room is full of knives.
The convoys meet at Stony Stratford around April 30th. Next morning, Richard arrests Earl Rivers, Sir Richard Grey, the King's half-brother, and Sir Thomas Vaughan. The message is, "I'm in charge now." Edward V, politely but firmly, is escorted to London.
Important context check, depositing a monarch to be in the Tower of London isn't a villain move by itself. The tower is a royal palace and fortress, pre-coronation lodging there is normal. What's not normal is the vibe, nobles splitting into camps, pro-Woodville versus anyone but Woodville.
In London, the council acknowledges Richard as Lord Protector while they prep for Edward V's coronation, which keeps getting pushed, first May, then June 22nd. Behind the scenes, alliances are shifting. Lord Hastings, longtime Yorkist power broker, backs Richard against the Woodvilles. Elizabeth Woodville, sensing the temperature, flees into sanctuary at Westminster Abbey with her daughters and her younger son, Richard, Duke of York.
Then comes the shocker, June 13, 1483. During a council meeting at the Tower, Richard accuses Hastings of treason, of conspiring with the Queen's faction, and Hastings is summarily executed that same day. No trial, no delay. That's a thunderclap, it tells everyone Richard is done negotiating.
Next domino, Richard wants both boys under his control. On June 16th, Cardinal Bourchier persuades Queen Elizabeth in sanctuary to release her younger son. Now Edward V and Richard of Shrewsbury are together in the tower, still consistent with a looming coronation, if you squint.
Meanwhile, the ideological groundwork gets poured. On June 22nd, a sermon at St. Paul's Cross, delivered by Dr. Ralph Shaw, claims Edward IV's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville was invalid due to a pre-contract with Eleanor Butler, née Talbot. If true, their children, including Edward V, are illegitimate. Legal thunder follows later under the statute Titulus Regius, but the pitch is made, no legitimate heirs from Edward IV.
Within days, the political theatre hits its climax. On June 25, a petition from Lords and Commons asks Richard to take the crown. He accepts on June 26. Richard III is crowned July 6, 1483.
Up to this point, every move has a veneer of procedure, protectorate, sermons, petitions. But stitched underneath is speed, intimidation, and ruthless control of the city's pressure points, the tower, the council, the pulpit.
And crucially, after early summer, public sightings of the princes taper off. That's the moment the mystery seeds are planted. The stage is now fully set.
Once both boys, Edward V and Richard, Duke of York, are inside the tower together after June 16, 1483, the paper trail thins and the eyewitness trail matters a lot. Early on, people still see the princes, glimpses at windows, movement in inner courts, normal for royal minors awaiting coronation.
Then the pattern shifts. After Richard III's coronation on July 6, reports say the princes are shown less and less. Household staff get trimmed. Attendants who made the boys visible, ushers, pages, tutors, are rotated or dismissed. That's not proof of foul play, but it reduces eyes and therefore reduces evidence.
Two near contemporary sources anchor what we think we know. First is Dominic Mancini, an Italian cleric in London in 1483. He leaves by year's end and writes that, by late summer, the princes were withdrawn from public view and people feared for their lives. He singles out Dr. John Argentine, a physician who attended Edward V, saying Argentine heard the boy confessing and preparing for death. It's secondhand, but it's close in time.
The second is the Croyland Chronicle, second continuation, composed by a well-informed insider a few years later. It's careful, almost loyally, but the gist matches. After the summer, no public appearances, the rumor mill says the worst has happened. Croyland doesn't say how or by whom, just that absence hardens into dread.
Inside the tower, custody changes matter. Sir Robert Brackenbury, a loyalist of Richard III, serves as the lieutenant of the tower, controlling access, keys, and guards. If you're looking for a gatekeeper who could restrict visibility, that's your man. We don't have a ledger that says, moved princes to X room on Y date, but we do have a power structure that concentrates control in Richard's hands through Brackenbury.
Outside the walls, politics react. In October 1483, Buckingham's rebellion launches. Early planning among some conspirators likely imagined restoring Edward V. By the time the rising breaks, messaging drifts toward Henry Tudor and a plan for him to marry Elizabeth of York, a pivot that makes sense only if people believe the princes are already dead or unreachable. That shift is indirect evidence of what the political class believed.
What about official statements? None. No proclamation of illness, no public funeral, no royal mourning orders. In a court that recorded ceremonies obsessively, that silence is deafening. If they died of natural causes, you'd expect some ceremonial response, even a managed one, to tamp down rumor. Instead, nothing.
And no financial breadcrumbs either, no surviving wardrobe or household entries that definitively prove their upkeep after late summer 1483. That doesn't mean there were none, records get lost, but the lack of clear payments to a living, royal-level household fits the pattern of disappearance rather than quiet retirement.
In the years that follow, stories congeal. Sir Thomas More later writes a vivid account. Sir James Tyrrell receives orders, gains the keys, and two men suffocate the boys, burying them under a tower stair. It's compelling, and colored by Tudor politics, written decades after the fact. Importantly, More's narrative is not our evidence for the disappearance itself, it's a later attempt to explain it.
So, to pin it down in plain language. Last solid phase of visibility, late June into July 1483. From July onward, sightings dwindle. By late summer, autumn 1483, London elites behave as if the princes are gone. No official cause, no bodies displayed, no funeral rites recorded.
That's the hardest thing about this case, the absence is the evidence. The tower was a palace that could make people very visible or invisible on purpose. After July 1483, the princes become the latter, and history has been trying to fill in that silence ever since. All right, time to open the case folder and flip through the tabs labeled Yikes. We'll go suspect by suspect, and for each one we'll ask three things: motive, why do it, means, Could they do it? Opportunity, when could they have done it? Then we'll stress test the story.
Plus a quick reminder, what we have is a fog of near-contemporary reports, later chronicles, and a lot of silence. This is a probability game, not a Perry Mason confession.
Suspect number 1, Richard III. That's the headline suspect, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, who becomes Richard III. Motive, crystal. Two living princes are magnets for rebellion. Even after Parliament later passes Titulus Regius, early 1484, declaring the boys illegitimate, a child with York blood can still be a rallying flag.
Means, total. As protector and then king, Richard controls the Tower of London, the Guard, and the city security apparatus through men like Sir Robert Brackenbury, the lieutenant of the Tower.
Opportunity. The tight window is July to early autumn 1483. Public sightings fade after Richard's July 6th coronation. Richard goes on royal progress in late July and August, which cuts both ways. He's away from London, but his authority is not.
Now the evidence people cite. The big narrative comes later from Sir Thomas More. He says Richard ordered Sir James Tyrrell to arrange the murders. Two underlings, often named John Dighton and Miles Forrest, suffocated the boys and buried them under a stair, later moving the bodies. It's detailed, dramatic, and written decades after, under Tudor rule, where making Richard look villainous is a career safe.
Counterpoint, if Richard had them killed, why not show the bodies and end the rumors? The comeback is, displaying murdered children could backfire spectacularly. A ruler might prefer plausible deniability, no princes, no proof.
Behavioral clues matter. After the boys disappear from view, Buckingham's rebellion erupts in October 1483. If Richard's goal was stability, it didn't work. But that doesn't mean he didn't try.
Stress test. Richard is the only person who checks all three boxes cleanly, motive, means, opportunity, without needing a Rube Goldberg subplot.
Suspect number 2, Henry Stafford, Duke of Buckingham, the human weather vane. Ally of Richard, then rebel against Richard, executed November 2, 1483 after his uprising fails.
Motive, ambition plus proximity. If the princes vanish, the succession board opens. Buckingham might imagine himself kingmaker, or king.
Means, partial. He's in Richard's inner circle during the takeover, he helps neutralize the Woodvilles, he has access to power. But the crucial question is tower access. Day-to-day keys sit with Brackenbury, not Buckingham. Could he lean on the system? Maybe. Could he bypass it? Harder.
Opportunity, narrow. If Buckingham did it, the likeliest window is summer 1483, before he breaks with Richard, or during the chaotic run-up to his October rebellion, though that's late and riskier.
The Buckingham theory often comes in two flavors. One, he acts with Richard's tacit approval, outsourcing the dirty work. Two, he freelances without Richard, hoping to force Richard's hand or create chaos he can ride. Both could fit his personality, he decisive, sometimes rash.
Stress test, plausible as agent or wild card, but the logistics still smell like royal-level authorization. If Buckingham acted alone, you have to imagine him seizing tower control long enough to do it and cover it, without leaving a paper or gossip trail that names him. That's a high-wire act.
Suspect number 3, Henry Tudor, Henry VII, and Margaret Beaufort. The future Henry VII is in exile in 1483, first in Brittany, then with French support. His mother, Margaret Beaufort, remains in England and is a network superconnector.
Motive, huge. The prince's gone equals a much cleaner road for Henry, especially once he promises to marry Elizabeth of York and unite claims.
Means, not great before 1485. Henry himself is abroad, any operation would require trusted agents inside the tower, inside London's guard structure, no small feat under Richard's nose.
Opportunity, better after Henry wins Bosworth, August 1485, and becomes king. But then the logic gets weird, if the princes were still alive at that point, producing them safely or publicly accounting for them could be even riskier for Henry's own claim. If they were already dead, he benefits politically from keeping the myth pointed at Richard.
Later, under Henry VII, Sir James Tyrrell is executed, 1490s. A confession is reported, implicating Richard, but the original text doesn't survive. That makes it useful propaganda and frustrating evidence.
Stress test, pre-1485, the access problem is enormous. Post-Bosworth, the incentive to keep the story blurry is real, but that makes them already gone more likely than Henry ordering a late cleanup.
Suspect number four, the instruments, Tyrell, Brackenberry, and co. Not masterminds, but the hands you'd need. Sir Robert Brackenberry, the tower's lieutenant, has the keys. Sir James Tyrell is a loyal soldier who, per some accounts, obtains temporary custody of the tower or the keys for a night. Names like John Dighton and Miles Forrest appear as the alleged suffocators in Moore's story.
If Richard orders the deed, the job almost certainly runs through Brackenberry or Tyrell. If Buckingham acts, he'd still need Brackenberry's cooperation or replacement. That's your choke point, access to the inner lodgings of royal miners.
Stress test, these figures make sense as means, not as motive. Their presence supports a top-down plot more readily than a rogue op.
Suspect number five, the system, illness, accident, or quiet burial. Not a person, but a scenario. The boys die of illness, common in the 15th century, while in custody. Richard, fearing blame, conceals it. No bodies displayed, no funeral pomp, no explanation, just silence that backfires.
Motive, self-preservation of regime image. Means, control the narrative by suppressing ceremonies. Opportunity, summer, autumn 1483.
Stress test, it explains the silence, but it requires Richard to make the worst PR choice available, hiding a natural death and birthing a permanent rumor machine. Possible, not elegant. Suspect number six, survival stories.
The romantic option, at least one prince escapes. Later, Perkin Warbeck claims to be Richard, Duke of York, and gathers serious backing abroad before Henry VII crushes the bid.
Motive, for co-conspirators keep a Yorkist heir alive as a future bargaining chip. Means, smuggle a child out of the most watched fortress in England, extremely hard unless an insider flips.
Stress test, it's the hardest to pull off quietly and keep quiet. The later pretender wave suggests demand for such a story, not proof of it. Where the needles point.
If you force us to place chips, the highest probability is Richard III either ordering or authorizing the removal of the princes, likely through Brackenberry and or Tyrell, during the July, autumn 1483 window.
Buckingham remains a strong secondary, as catalyst, helper, or rogue, with the caveat that tower access still runs through royal authority.
Henry VII or Beaufort before 1485? Low odds due to access. After 1485, the politics of silence fit a world where the boys are already gone and the winner has zero incentive to exhume truth that could complicate his crown.
Bottom line for a court of history verdict, not proven. But if you're mapping motive plus means plus opportunity, the straightest line still runs to Richard III, not because he's Shakespeare's villain, but because his power intersects the window when the princes simply stop being seen.
All right, let's talk evidence, the stuff you can actually point to, poke at, and then argue about for 3 hours over lukewarm ale.
Starting with the most cinematic piece, the bones in the tower. In 1674, workmen demolishing a staircase in the White Tower reportedly find a pit with the remains of two youngsters. Big gasp, lots of pointing, and King Charles II orders the bones placed in a little urn and interred in Westminster Abbey in the Henry VII Lady Chapel. There's even an inscription that basically says, yep, these are the princes, which, to be clear, is a claim, not a lab result.
Fast forward to 1933. The Abbey opens the urn and a small team, Lawrence Tanner from the Abbey, Professor William Wright, and Dr. George Northcroft, examines the contents. Their verdict? The bones could belong to two children about the right ages. But, and this is important, they couldn't determine cause of death, and they couldn't prove identity. The remains were jumbled, mixed with animal bones, and not in pristine archaeological context. It's less CSI finale, more box of puzzle pieces with half the picture missing.
Could we solve it today with DNA and radiocarbon dating? Maybe. But you'd need permission from the Abbey to reopen the urn, and possibly permission to test other royal remains for comparison, like Edward IV or Elizabeth Woodville at St. George's Chapel, Windsor. That means multiple authorities and a lot of ethical and custodial hurdles. Even the DNA is tricky, remember the Richard III project? His mtDNA matched female line descendants, but his Y chromosome didn't match some supposed Plantagenet lines, suggesting a historical break in the male line somewhere. Translation, the simple match the prince's to Richard III Y DNA isn't a slam dunk. Autosomal DNA could help, but you'd still need clean, comparative samples.
So the bones are a maybe. What about paper evidence? Two near-contemporary voices matter most. First, Dominic Mancini, an Italian observer in London in 1483. He writes soon after leaving England that by late summer the princes were withdrawn from view and people feared the worst. He name-drops Dr. John Argentine, who supposedly heard Edward V confessing and preparing for death. It's second-hand, but close in time and very sober in tone.
Then there's the Croyland Chronicle, written by someone with good connections inside the political class, probably in the mid-1480s. Croyland is careful, no sensational detail, just the core fact that after the summer of 1483 the princes aren't seen, and rumor hardens into a belief that they're gone. It's like the Chronicle equivalent of a raised eyebrow.
Later writers crank up the detail. Sir Thomas More, around 1513, gives the most famous narrative. Richard III supposedly orders Sir James Tyrrell to arrange the murders. John Dighton and Miles Forrest smother the boys. The bodies are tucked under a stair, then moved. It's vivid, it's memorable, and it's decades later under Tudor rule. That doesn't make it false, but it does put a political thumb on the scale. Polydore Virgil, also writing under Tudors, reinforces the idea that Richard bears responsibility, again without court records or a murder weapon on a velvet cushion.
Speaking of records, historians went hunting for household accounts, you know, the receipts and payroll scribbles that bureaucracies can't help generating. After summer 1483, we don't have clear, continuing payments that look like a royal household for two living boys of that rank. That absence is suggestive, but not definitive. A lot of records from the period are lost or fragmentary. Still, if the princes were being kept comfortably somewhere for years, you'd expect some paper shadow.
Another silence, no proclamation, no funeral. If the boys died naturally, illness was common, you'd expect carefully staged mourning and ceremony. That's how late medieval courts managed legitimacy and rumor. Instead, we get nothing. And that nothing echoes.
People sometimes ask, well, what about the other bones discovered in and around the tower over the centuries? London soil is basically a historical lasagna. There have been multiple finds of juvenile remains in the area. Without context and testing, you can't just slap a label on any two small skeletons and say, princes. Provenance is everything.
So where does that leave us? On one side, you've got contemporary-ish witnesses saying, we stopped seeing them, and we're scared of what that means. On another, you've got later narratives offering motives, names, and a method, useful stories, but colored by who was in power. And then you've got the physical remains. Tantalizing but inconclusive without modern analysis that, so far, hasn't been permitted.
Put differently, the evidence we do have is mostly negative, an absence of sightings, an absence of ceremony, an absence of ongoing expenses, stitched together with rumor, political context, and a box of bones that refuses to testify. It's enough to draw probabilities, not enough to deliver a courtroom conviction.
Which is why this mystery still has legs. The receipts that would end the argument either never existed, were destroyed, or are sitting somewhere behind a wall we haven't knocked down yet. Until then, we're all reading shadows on the tower's stone and arguing about which shadow looks most like the truth. Let's do the ruthless but rational thought experiment. If you're a late, 15th century power player staring at two underage claimants, what move best protects your crown?
First, a quick cheat sheet on medieval politics. Legitimacy isn't just bloodlines, it's a cocktail of law, ritual, oaths, church vibes, and public theatre. You can win a crown on a battlefield, but you keep it by managing stories, who's lawful, who's blessed, who's safe.
Now, Richard III's menu of options in mid-1483. Keep the princes alive but disqualified by law, titulus regius. Pros, looks legal and tidy. You can point to Parliament and say, see? Illegitimate. Case closed. Cons. Living child princes are magnets for rebellions and foreign plots. They need households, guards, tutors, paper trails and witnesses. One sympathetic jailer, one daring rescue, and your regime is toast. Exile them, ship them quietly to Burgundy or elsewhere. Pros: out of your immediate hair. Cons: they become hostages to fortune. A foreign court can parade a prince whenever it wants leverage. You've handed your enemies a living banner. Eliminate them in secret and never acknowledge it. Pros: removes the rallying point. No funeral, no relics, no graves to weep over. Cons: a permanent rumor machine. Killing royal children is the kind of moral stain that makes oaths go wobbly and sermons get spicy.
The pattern we actually see after summer 1483, no public sightings, no funeral, no tidy exile rumor, is most consistent with option 3. Not proven, but the behavior matches: tighten access, reduce witnesses, never produce a body.
Richard's follow-up politics read like someone shoring up legitimacy after a hard choice. He pushes a legal narrative, sermon at St. Paul's Cross and then Titulus Regius, to redefine the boys as non-heirs. He does a highly visible royal progress to court the shires. His 1484 Parliament sprinkles popular measures, reforming aspects of law and trade. That's all win hearts and minds governance.
And yet the street-level barometer, Buckingham's rebellion in October 1483, spikes. That rising is crucial politically. Some conspirators initially talk like they'll restore Edward V, and very quickly the message pivots to Henry Tudor, with a plan for him to marry Elizabeth of York. That pivot screams, "We think the princes are dead or unreachable." Rebellion sell what people might buy. If the boys were alive and retrievable, that would have been the headline.
What about Buckingham himself as mastermind? Politically, he's the classic overmighty magnate, huge regional power, sudden ambition. He could plausibly act as agent or freelancer, hoping to force events and make himself kingmaker. But here's the choke point: Tower access sits with royal officers like Sir Robert Brackenbury. Even a swaggering duke usually needs royal authorization or royal-level collusion to move within those walls. That pushes the politics back toward Richard's circle, whether directing or condoning.
Flip the board: Henry Tudor and Margaret Beaufort. Pre-1485, their politics are network and narrative, letters, oaths, French help, not keys to the Tower. Post-Bosworth, the winning politics is unity theatre. Henry marries Elizabeth of York, repeals Titulus Regius, and retroactively legitimises Edward IV's children to strengthen his own heirs. If the princes had been alive then, acknowledging them would explode his claim. So his best play is to keep the story blurry and let Richard own the blame.
The church piece matters too. Publicly displaying murdered child princes risks turning them into martyrs. Bad optics in an age where sermons shape politics. If Richard was responsible, silence protects him from both theology, God hates tyrants, and PR, behold the child killer. If someone else acted, Richard's silence might be reluctant. He inherits the mess and can't fix it without blowing up his own legitimacy story.
Add a destabilizer: in 1484, Richard's only legitimate son, Edward of Middleham, dies. From a politics perspective, that's a gut punch. A king without a clear heir looks vulnerable, a nervous noble start gaming contingencies. If the princes were alive somewhere, that moment would have been irresistible for plotters. Nothing surfaces. Politically, that absence again points to no living princes to rally around.
Foreign policy also nudges the probabilities. France and Brittany eventually back Henry Tudor. If even one prince were verifiably alive, a savvy foreign court would shove him to the front of the anti-Ricardian parade. Instead, the export-ready product is Tudor plus Elizabeth of York equals national healing. That's the politics of a vacuum where the boys used to be.
So where do the incentives land? For Richard, the cold arithmetic says living princes equals chronic instability. The least bad path, if you're genuinely ruthless, is removal plus silence plus legality theatre. For Buckingham, the best play is chaos he can ride. He still needs royal mechanisms to touch the Tower. For Henry VII, the winning script after 1485 is unity and amnesia: marry York, bury the paperwork, let Richard shoulder the vilification.
None of that is courtroom proof. But politics is a behavioral science. You infer decisions from the trail they leave. What we can observe: legal repositioning, rumor-resistant silence, rebel messaging pivot, foreign backing calculus, fits a world in which the princes do not survive the 1483 window, and in which the principle with the cleanest means plus motive plus opportunity is Richard III.
That's why the historical needle tilts his way, not because Shakespeare gives him the best villain speeches, but because when you model the choices each actor faced, his choices map most closely to the world we can still see.
Let's circle back to the most movie-ready clue, the staircase bones. In 1674, workmen tearing down a staircase in the White Tower, that's the keep inside the Tower of London, hit a pit containing the remains of two youngsters. Word shoots up the chain, and Charles II orders them placed in a funerary urn and interred in Westminster Abbey's Henry VII Lady Chapel. An inscription more or less anoints them as the princes. Is that proof? Not really. It's a 17th-century best guess wrapped in royal ceremony.
And then they sit, undisturbed, until 1933, when Westminster Abbey opens the urn for a look. A small team, Lawrence Tanner, the Abbey's archivist, Professor William Wright, and Dr. George Northcroft, examines the jumble. Their take? The bones are consistent with two children roughly the right ages. But the context was messy, mixed with animal bones, disturbed, not a neat burial, and there was no way to pin identity or cause of death. So, tantalizing, not conclusive.
Cue the modern science question everyone asks, why not do DNA? In theory, we could try. In practice, you'd need, 1, permission to reopen the urn, 2, comparative royal DNA, think Edward IV or Elizabeth Woodville, which means more permissions from other custodians, and, 3, enough uncontaminated material to test without destroying what little we have. There are also technical wrinkles. Radiocarbon dating can be skewed by high medieval fish consumption, and the Y chromosome is tricky because a well-publicized test on Richard III showed a male line mismatch with some living Plantagenet claimants, meaning somewhere in the centuries, a non-paternity event crept in. That doesn't invalidate Richard's ID, his mtDNA matched, but it warns you that a simple Y match the prince's plan can go sideways.
Now, fast forward to the 2010s and what I like to call the Ricardian revival. In 2012, a joint effort led by Philippa Langley and the Richard III Society, working with archaeologists from the University of Leicester, digs up a city car park and, no kidding, finds a medieval friary and a skeleton. The remains show scoliosis, multiple perimortem battle wounds, and the burial context fits a high-status interment in Greyfriars. Forensics and genealogy lock it in. Richard III is back, scientifically identified and reburied with ceremony at Leicester Cathedral in 2015.
That discovery does two big things for our story. First, it proves that modern archaeology can rewrite royal history, which supercharges calls to apply the same toolkit to the Abbey urn. If we can pull a king out of a car park and confirm him, why not test two children in an urn? Second, it humanizes Richard. The scoliosis isn't Shakespeare's cartoon hunch, it's a real, asymmetrical spine on a hardened soldier king. That nuance fuels a broader reappraisal. Were some Tudor-era villain tales overcooked?
And yet, the prince's file stays shut. Westminster Abbey has, so far, declined to reopen the urn. Their reasons mix ethics, respecting the dead, stewardship, don't destroy irreplaceable remains chasing a maybe, and doubt about whether testing would truly settle identity. Even if you get DNA, you still need clean comparators, you still face statistical caveats, and you still might end up with a probable rather than a parade-ready certainty.
Meanwhile, the Richard III Society and a wave of new scholarship keep pressure on the narrative. The Leicester finds sparks documentaries, academic volumes, and a public debate about what we know versus what we perform about late medieval kingship. It also briefly reopens old legal and heritage arguments, where to bury a king, who gets to decide, reminding everyone that medieval bones can cause very modern headaches.
So where does this leave the staircase bones? Still in their urn. Still the most obvious physical candidates for the princes. Still untested by 21st century standards. And because the Richard III discovery made science look like a magic wand, public patience for no testing gets thinner each year, even if the scientific and ethical calculus is genuinely complicated.
Bottom line, the 2010s Ricardian revival proved that careful archaeology and genetics can crack open a chapter that looked sealed. It didn't solve the princes. What it did was raise the stakes. If we ever get permission, the Abbey urn could deliver clarity, or another elegant maybe. Until then, the 1674 staircase is less a smoking gun than a locked drawer we're not allowed to open. All right, time for our verdict, delivered with maximum humility. We're not handing down a courtroom conviction, we're sketching probabilities.
And when we stack motive, means, and opportunity, the most direct line still runs through Richard III in the July-autumn 1483 window, likely acting via trusted officers such as Sir Robert Brackenbury and possibly Sir James Tyrrell. The pattern fits, the boy's visibility collapses after July, there's no credible exile rumor, and there's none of the ceremonial footprint you'd expect if they'd died naturally. It's this least contradictory explanation rather than a signed confession.
One extra clue that nudges the needle, a 1516 will, drawn up around the same time Thomas More was composing his account, mentions a gold chain that had belonged to Edward V. It turns up in the orbit of the Tyrrell, Capel families. That's intriguing because Tyrrell is the man later named as the fixer in More's narrative. Finding an intimate royal object, decades later, inside a suspect's extended network doesn't prove the murders, but it does suggest proximity. Someone close to Tyrrell had custody of a prince's personal item.
And here's why that matters for how we read Thomas More. The Capels' family lawyer for years was Sir John More, Thomas More's father. In other words, Thomas wasn't just a clever writer with a Tudor audience, he was close to a channel of information that brushed up against Tyrell's world. That doesn't make every flourish in his story gospel, but it raises the floor on his access and plausibility.
So, with all that on the table, here's how our probabilities shake out. Most likely, Richard III authorizes removal of the princes, method uncertain, during 1483, using Tower insiders, Brackenbury, Tyrrell, or both. The later appearance of Edward V chain in the Tyrrell, Capel circle meshes with that pathway. Plausible secondary, Buckingham as catalyst or agent, ambitious enough to try, volatile enough to do it, but still facing the Tower access choke point, which lived under royal control. Lower probability, Henry VII or Margaret Beaufort before 1485 they had an access problem. After 1485, their winning politics is unity and silence, which fits a world where the boys are already gone rather than hidden off stage.
What about the gentler scenarios, illness, accident, or a quiet, unannounced burial? They're possible. But each asks us to swallow extra complications the record doesn't show, total silence from a court that loved ceremony, zero funerary observance for two royal children, and no ongoing household expenses you'd expect if they were alive in seclusion. Add in that gold chain drifting into the Tyrrell orbit by 1516, and the soft explanations start to wobble.
Survival tales? Romantic, but logistically brutal. Smuggling a prince out of the most watched fortress in England and keeping him useful and secret for years, with no solid paper trail, requires a miracle plus a time machine. The later pretenders show there was demand for the story, not that the story was true.
Our humble bottom line, the case remains not proven. But the political behavior we can observe, the Tower's bottleneck of access, the timing of the boy's disappearance, and that 1516 chain, all of it together keeps pulling the probability curve toward Richard III, with Tyrrell as the likely operational bridge. If modern science ever meets modern permissions on those Abbey remains, we might move from probabilities to proof. Until then, we're living with the sharpest silhouette in English history, clear outline, missing face.
So why does a 540-year-old cold case still grab us by the collar? Because it sits at the crossroads of power, story, and evidence, the same intersection where a lot of our modern debates live.
Start with source literacy. The princes teach you to ask, who wrote this? When? For whom? Mancini writes close to the moment, but he's an outsider. Croyland is careful and cagey. Thomas More writes later, with Tudor gravity tugging at his sleeve. Shakespeare turns politics into poetry, and poetry sticks. The case is a masterclass in weighing proximity, bias, and genre.
And it's a clinic in how legitimacy is manufactured. Look at the sequence, sermon at St. Paul's, council choreography, Titulus Regius, then a coronation tour. That's the medieval version of a full court press. Swap out pulpits for press conferences and parchment for push alerts and you've got a very modern playbook. Control the process, control the narrative, hope reality follows.
Which leads to propaganda literacy. Once a story calcifies, Richard the Child Killer or, for his defenders, Richard the Maligned Reformer, it becomes cultural concrete. The princes are a reminder that the most persuasive version often wins airtime, not necessarily the truest. If that feels contemporary,
it also matters for forensic ethics. Should we test the Abbey bones? That pits our hunger for answers against respect for the dead and stewardship of fragile remains. Add the technical caveats, contamination, sample destruction, matching comparators, and you've got a real-world seminar in what science can do and what it should do. It's not press the DNA button, solve the past. It's trade-offs, consent, and probabilities.
The case spotlights archives and absence. We are haunted by what didn't survive, missing ledgers, lost letters, vanished orders. Most histories are stitched from holes. Learning to read silence, no public sightings, no funeral, no household expenses, is a transferable skill. It helps you navigate any field where the data is incomplete, intelligence work, journalism, even corporate audits.
Then there's law as a political tool. The pre-contract claim and Titulus Regius show how statutes can rearrange reality overnight. Children go from heirs to illegitimate with the stroke of a pen. Later, repealing the statute rewrites it again. That's not just medieval drama, it's a reminder that legal frameworks can stabilize or destabilize legitimacy in any era.
The princes also give us a lens on childhood and power. In medieval politics, children aren't shielded, they're leverage. That should make us think about how states treat the vulnerable when legitimacy is on the line, who gets protected, and who becomes a pawn.
On the cultural side, the mystery shows how art builds memory. Most people meet Richard III first through Shakespeare. That theatrical imprint shapes how we interpret evidence after the fact, confirmation bias with a velvet doublet. Knowing that helps us check our own mental stage sets in other debates.
It's also a story about communities of inquiry. Ricardians, traditionalists, archaeologists, genealogists, amateur sleuths, sometimes they clash, sometimes they collaborate, but collectively they keep the question alive. That's healthy. It's a reminder that history isn't a monologue, it's a conversation across time with lots of footnotes and a fair bit of side eye.
And let's be honest, mystery is sticky. Uncertainty is a feature, not a bug, for why people return to this case. It invites what-if scenarios, and that keeps the public engaged with history as a living puzzle, not a dead list of dates. When done well, the princes become a gateway drug into serious skills, evaluating claims, following a chain of custody, separating possible from probable.
There's even a heritage governance angle. Who decides whether to open an urn, where to rebury a king, how to prioritize competing claims, church, crown, city, descendants, scholars? Those are live questions in museums and archives everywhere. The princes connect to broader debates about stewardship, consent, and the politics of remembrance.
Finally, the case is a mirror. Every generation projects its anxieties onto it. The Tudors needed a villain, the Victorians wanted moral clarity, the 20th century wanted forensic proof, and we want transparency with receipts. The princes let us watch our own values at work.
So why it still matters? Because it trains muscles we need now, skepticism without cynicism, curiosity with guardrails, empathy for people trapped in systems bigger than themselves, and humility about what we can actually know.
The tower's stones won't talk. But the way we listen to the echoes, carefully, critically, and with our minds open to revision, that's the part that makes this more than a Tudor ghost story. It makes it practice for being a better thinker today. And that's our dive into the princes in the tower, mystery, politics, and a whole lot of careful inference.
Huge thanks for spending your time with us. You all are the reason we get to nerd out every week, and we don't take that lightly.
Quick reminder, our episodes are evergreen. Share this with a friend next week, next month, or next year. It'll still make sense and, fingers crossed, still spark an argument over dinner.
If you liked today's episode, the single best way to help is a 5-star review. Seriously, that tiny tap tells the algorithm we're worth recommending. It helps new folks find us, and it keeps the show growing.
Hit follow or subscribe, and if you know someone who loves a good historical whodunit, text them this episode right now.
Got ideas for future topics? Send them our way on social. We read your DMs, polls, and spicy threads. Your suggestions often become full episodes.
Also, we've got brand new merch, tees, mugs, and notebooks with our favorite trust, but verify vibes. The links in the show notes.
And a shout out to our production crew and our research assistant powered by the latest AI architecture, fast, efficient, and always sanity checking our sources so the history stays sharp.
I'm Chuck.
I'm Marco.
This is the History AI Podcast. Thanks for listening. Rate, subscribe, share, and we'll see you next time.
Sinking tower lights blink, nobody speaks. Ravens on railings, keys in a fist, hold and release. Uncle's ring glitters, the council just calls it peace. If truth has a hallway, someone jammed the door. All that's left is echoes spilling on the floor. Pay the cost. If now